Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 88. On this episode of the podcast, we are talking about Oscar favorite, The Revenant. The Revenant was directed by Alejandro Iñárritu, who also directed Birdman last year, for those of you who may have not made that connection yet. To help me talk about this film, we have brought on Laura Fissel and John Booker, two excellent guests who help us break down the Oscar favorite. And speaking of Oscar favorites, it's kind of odd that it's such an Oscar favorite, but yet not necessarily a critic favorite. So we talk about that. We talk about the huge amounts of thematic depth that this film has, mainly what drives people to fight so hard for life, and, you know, tons of other good stuff. Meanwhile, this might be Leonardo DiCaprio or Tom Hardy's big chance to snag an Oscar, so make sure you're listening in for our thoughts on that. And while you're checking things out, make sure you check out realworldtheology.com for new reviews, top five lists, streaming recommendations, and podcasts just like this one. Follow us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Real World Theo and Real World Theology, respectively. Subscribe to the podcast in whichever way you feel that is best for your lifestyle. And whatever that is, please review us on that medium. It helps us so much when you guys review the show. And be looking for new episodes, especially of Oscar contenders, the next 1st, 10th, 20th of the month. That's when we put all these things out. So, rate and review the show. Tell your friends. Let us know what you loved about the conversation. This is a really great, great show. And here it is. Episode 88, The Revenant and the Fear of Death.
Well, so how are people finding you? What is your connection, especially to something like DC? How are you showing up on their radar?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a couple of different things. One of the big things that opened up for me, I guess it was 2 years ago, is when HBO contacted me about writing about The Leftovers. Mm-hmm. You know, and that has really sprung into a lot of different opportunities. It made my Twitter following go way up, and that was kind of the catalyst that really started a lot of it. But, you know, as far as comics and things like that go, I have known a lot of people in the comic industry, throughout the years, and have a lot of friends, you know, that are comic writers. Mm-hmm. And who have done some big projects. And my name was given to them by a dear friend who works at DC Comics. Oh. And yeah, they said, hey, you should totally, talk to him about coming and doing something with you guys, because he knows his stuff. He knows mythology really well. And so that, you know, it really does go back often to who you know, man. So.
Well, but in this case, it also seems like it doesn't hurt that you know somebody, but you also know your stuff.
Yeah, so, that's the really important thing is that, you know, if you don't have anything to say, if you don't really know your stuff. And for me, it's been about keeping kind of a body of work out there. Mm-hmm. That people can constantly go see and hear new stuff that I'm, you know, it's why I love doing podcasts is, it's just more opportunity to get to connect with other people and new audiences and people that I don't often, you know, necessarily get to talk to. And mm-hmm. Here's the thing. If you guys were, flying into LA this week, I would totally want to sit down with Mikey and Laura and have a nice dinner and talk about things. But since we can't do that, let's just have a nice conversation anyway, and let's record it and put it up for everybody to listen to.
Well, I mean, because that's the heart of all podcasting. People think that you have something that's worthwhile for other people to hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't mind having that little bit of ego involved. I mean,
No.
So again, sadly, it's been, I think, right at a year since you were on the podcast last, and it's cool to have you on kind of after not having been on for a while. And there's sadly a good chance that this will be the last time Laura's on for a while.
What?
Yeah. just because I don't,
you don't trust my brain after giving birth to a child? What? You don't think I can form cohesive thoughts?
I'm not saying that. I'm just...
Laura, I thought it was more because your celebrity had gotten so big. You were just too big
can't
to do
afford
this
me.
Kind of thing.
Yeah. Exactly. That's why I have to send her emails. I'm like, dearest sweetie, would you like to be on the Revenant podcast? She's like, I'll check my calendar. I'm very busy.
My people get with your people.
She's like, I'll have my admin assistant get back to you. I have a very busy next 6 months. But I wanted to make sure I got everyone. And there's so many movies to talk about, especially going into Oscar season, you know, because everything comes out right at the last minute, right?
Yep.
So, which good and bad? Good, because we know we're going to get tons of good movies, right? Bad, because we know we're going to get tons of good movies and we only have so much time.
So
the other thing is that it covers up for the fact that typically during January and February, there's nothing new coming out. Is
really, because there's a lot of stuff I want to see coming out this month. Is that unusual?
You mean January or February?
February.
Yeah, so not February yet. So there's like two or three things that are coming out in February that we want to see and that we want to kind of talk about. But for the most part, you know, especially like October, November, December, there's something coming out, maybe two movies a week. There for a while. But you know, in January you might have, I think, like the only thing that technically is coming out in January, even though for most of us, we're really just now getting, you know, The Hateful Eight and Room and Brooklyn are coming back to theaters. And The Revenant, obviously, is not being released for the normal audiences until January. Yeah. But if you don't count those things, then I think the only thing that was really on our schedule might be something that's coming out the week that we record this. Which would be like Kung Fu Panda 3, which we'd probably do eventually, just because we don't get a chance to do very many animated movies. But then again, it depends on how many people go see that, what kind of message it has, things like that.
Sure.
So, I mean, all January.
That's true. That's why we watched so many awful movies this month.
But, you know, February...
We just kept hitting duds over and over.
Yeah, February gets a little bit better. I mean, you know, but, you know, and then March is pushing in a little bit. You know, the success of the Lego Movie a couple years ago let people kind of realize that if they throw that one gem, you know, in the mire, that they might be able to hit it.
I'll tell you one that's coming, that comes out this month, that I got to see last month in a pre-screening, that has a lot of really interesting kind of, you know, theological and spiritual connotations. I really wasn't into seeing the movie, but, you know, I I got invited to. But The Finest Hours, that's the new film from Chris Pine and Casey Affleck. It's the true story of the guys that from the U.S. Coast Guard, the most dangerous Coast Guard rescue.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. It is directed by Craig Gillespie, that did Lars and the Real Girl and Million Dollar Arm.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really the predominant theme. There's two predominant themes in the film. One is this idea of a guy saying, here am I, send me into this dangerous, you know, mission. Mm-hmm. And then the second kind of predominant theme is this idea of, we're all in this together, that, you know, on this boat, it's like the guys basically have all these opportunities to just save themselves and they refuse to do it. It's like, if we, you know, if those guys go down, we're all going down together. And so there's some pretty powerful and profound spiritual themes in that film that I was pretty taken with. So just keep that one on your radar. It's, you know, it's a Disney film, but it's Disney's attempt to kind of, you know, make something for kids and adults. I think it's PG-13, but it was pretty great. I actually liked it a lot.
I was actually interested in seeing it for the longest time. I think because I thought it was supposed to come out maybe in November.
Yeah, I think they delayed it.
And then, when it got pushed back to January, I get very hesitant
when
things are pushed from the October-November window into January, because I assume they're doing this because, you know, it's not really competitive.
My understanding was Disney had kind of an all-hands-on-deck thing for Star Wars, and so it got pushed back just because the marketing arm had to do... You know, had to basically be fully give their full attention to Star Wars.
Yeah, they were like, we got to put Star Wars stuff on oranges. We don't have time
for any
other movies. Well,
this is important, guys.
Well, I think the themes that you mentioned are probably from The Finest Hour is the opposite of some of the themes we might see in The Revenant.
Yeah.
Isn't that the truth? Yeah.
And the thing about The Revenant is it is chock full of big names. I mean, from famous cinematographers, production designers, to, you know, the guy who won the little director Oscar last year.
You might remember him.
You know, which I want to pronounce his last name, but I am so afraid that I will pronounce it as bad as the head of the Academy did.
Oh, that was awful.
Because she was like, Alejandro Inarritu.
Talk about putting in letters that don't exist.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm really going to do a bad name drop here. Uh-oh. So just forgive me. But I actually got to go to the red carpet premiere and meet him. And I got to ask him, I was like, how do you pronounce your name? And he said it with such an accent that I won't be able to repeat it. But basically he said, it's Inarritu.
Inarritu.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Inarritu. So that was straight from the horse's mouth.
There you go.
I was gonna say, yeah, I'm not gonna argue. I wasn't there, and so I'm fine with you name dropping to name correct.
Okay,
but I mean, like, so you know, this is probably, I mean, if Star Wars didn't come out, I think the second most anticipated film of anyone who saw a trailer for the second half of 2015. Was this movie. And, you know, sadly, most people didn't get to really see it until the, you know, first two or three weeks of January in 2016, just because of the way, you know, movie releases go with Oscar nominated films and stuff. But, you know, you take the guy who just won an Oscar for best director, you add DiCaprio, who most people think should have won multiple Oscars already.
Yeah.
You add Tom Hardy, who has been in tons of great movies this year. And continue. I think him and what was the conversation we had? I feel like between him and Alicia Vikander, like were they were just killing everything.
They were like, take this half of the movies this year, and I'll take
and
this
I'll take
half.
This, we'll do excellent jobs in all of them. So you know, Tom Hardy is finally like a household name now, and the other ironic thing, even though it's a very small part, I would say in. Like four of my top 10 movies this year, Donald Gleason was in them, you know, like, how does he keep getting in these movies?
I tell you, and his dad is an amazing actor as well.
Exactly. I mean, because Calvary last year was,
killed it.
You know,
I think it was my number one.
I think Calvary and Whiplash were right there. They were, So, I mean, I say all that to be like, this movie had all the pieces to be great. Like, it had all the reasons for people to hype it up beyond hype.
Yeah.
And honestly, I wasn't really let down.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because I read a very interesting review on Letterboxd that made this comment. The reviewer said, or at least started their review by saying, it's hard to talk about The Revenant without talking about its detractors. And I was like, I instantly connected with this because after seeing the film, I couldn't imagine anyone not liking it on some level. But it seems like there are now criticisms that Inarritu is too indulgent, all flash, no substance, especially like, you know, now that he's won something, he can kind of do what he wants. Heck, even the review that we posted on Real World Theology by our own Blaine Grimes, like in his review, he called what we see... at times it feels like Inarritu is trying to do his best Terrence Malick impression, and it's an attempt that fails miserably. So I had to instantly message him and be like, what are you talking about, Blaine?
I didn't let
you review this movie to bash it. It's great. So I guess
pick your people more wisely.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. It's hard to find good health these days, right? So I guess I wanted to put one of the first questions on this episode to you guys. And John, you're on Skype, so you get to answer most of these questions first. Not that we want to, detract from the lovely and beautiful Laura in here.
No, I am happy, Laura. Anytime you want to jump in and answer first, you just go.
John, would you say this movie? I feel like I know your answer, but I'm kind of leading you a little bit. Is the movie empty outside of Emmanuel Lubezki's astonishing cinematography? Like, is there nothing else but this beautiful? Visually beautiful movie that we're seeing?
No. This is a film that has something to say. I mean, this is a film that has substance and content beyond just the visuals. This is a film that the theme is expressed through language, through what we see, and then through that sort of communication that only film is capable of, that it speaks directly to people's hearts and spirits. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a lot more going on here than just the story about a man trying to get revenge.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, I would tend to agree. And Laura, how did you feel? Did you?
Oh, absolutely. And it's especially astonishing because they're kind of like Mad Max. There's very little dialogue. I guess if you think about the movie as a whole, there's a lot being told in a variety of ways, not just through language. Mm-hmm. And, oh man, there's so many things to talk about in this film. Just through images or through ways that things were shot.
Yeah, not just because they're pretty.
Yeah.
But because they carry weight.
Oh yeah, every choice felt really purposeful.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And you know, I don't consider myself like a film connoisseur, but so there are some directors that that people rave about that I'm like, I didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But I felt very clearly communicated with during this whole film.
Mm. And I think that says a lot, too, because, you know, it's hard for a film to be able to speak to, you know, connoisseurs mm-hmm. and non-connoisseurs alike. And I feel like, in my opinion, this film does both. So, John, what could you say or what explanation could you give for any kind of critical backlash against this film? Like, why are people not seeing what we're seeing in this film?
Yeah. Well, I want to be careful. I mean, there's in our age of, you know, of internet armchair critics where everybody, you know, has a platform to express their beliefs there.
Yeah.
With any project and any film, there are legitimate criticisms, and I'll certainly give a few legitimate criticisms, I feel mm-hmm. like, of the film. But I have a friend that often says that it takes that any donkey can tear down a barn, but it takes a really special one to build one. And so I feel like, you know, it's the same way, you know, with films. Anybody, you know, with a computer can get online and write really even intelligent, you know, things where the film didn't live up to their expectations or is lacking. But I feel like those folks are in the minority. I also feel like this. If you look at this film and you look at what the director and the actor set out to accomplish, does the film succeed on those terms?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you have a tough time saying that it doesn't. I think they really succeeded in what they set out to do with the film. And for those who... I feel like also when you read a critique of The Revenant, you somehow get a sense of those who legitimately have some issues with the film, and then those who have seen how well the film has done, how well the film is liked, and there's always going to be a segment of people that say, ah, people love this. I'm going to find things that I don't like about it so I can be that guy.
That guy.
Yeah.
Or that girl, you know.
Or that girl.
21st yeah. century, John.
My experience is most of the time it's that guy.
Yeah, that's true. Well, actually, that's interesting that you say that because that's kind of one of my working hypotheses. And in a very similar way, I don't want to get too down because... You know, there are some legitimate complaints that you can level against basically almost any film.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But I feel like there was this line of thinking with many popular critics. And that's kind of like they have this job that says, I'm supposed to frown upon blockbusters.
Yeah.
Because they're too simple.
Yeah.
And I'm supposed to love slow, deep, out of the box, just gems where people are thinking and introspective. Yeah. And it's like, that's what I'm supposed to do as a critic. Like you don't really get to turn your nose up until you're at that point. And so this is the latter, with the appeal of the former.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's slow, deep and out of the box, but it also like people love this movie. Like yeah. the average person who goes to see this movie is impressed
mm-hmm.
because yeah. it's not something they've ever seen. And yeah. you know, it's making a lot of money because of that. Yeah. So I feel like I kind of joke that critics have to make a choice.
Yeah.
Do they want to like it because it's out of the box, or do they want to not like it so they can kind of separate themselves from the average viewer? And it seems like some people have decided to not like it just out of cynicism.
Sure. viewing film is such a personal experience, you know? Mm-hmm. There are films that speak to me. There are films that touch me and that touch my heart because of what I bring in to the theater. Mm-hmm. Not every film is for every audience, and not every audience is for every film, and that's okay. But I do think that there's a lot to be said when a film resonates with a large group of people. We have to look at what is it about that film that resonates. Mm-hmm. It's not enough to just say, oh, I liked the film or I enjoyed it. What specifically, you know, is resonating with a group of people? And you have a lot of people this film is resonating with. So I think we have to, you know, dig deeper and say, what is it, you know, about this story, about the execution of the story that is really drawing people in?
No, I really like that you put it that way, too, because that's often what people ask of me when they hear that I have a podcast. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, you're Christian. You have a podcast. I assume that you will be covering, you know, fill in the blank with Christian movie.
Yeah.
And I'm like, actually, no, because people aren't watching those movies.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, on the large part. Mm-hmm. Right. That's not obviously always the case. I was like, but I feel like we should examine a movie that is, you know, earning $30 million a week for 4 weeks in a row.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because people are going to see it. And it's obviously connecting with them. So maybe we should take a look at that.
Yeah.
Instead of like the small, you know, redoing for the 100th time, like Life of Jesus film mm-hmm. that makes $3 million.
Yeah.
Not that there's not value in that one, but when we're looking at cultural narratives, we have to look at what's the culture's being narrated.
So are we going to answer this question?
No. So, well, hold on. So, Laura, I want to give you a chance too. Can you think of any reason why people would like kind of be down on this film?
Oh, no. I really can't, because I'm not really in the critic world very mm-hmm. much, and so I consider myself more of like the average plebeian going to see a film.
I the humble movie goer.
Yes. No, I really when I read so I've read several negative reviews about it, and every time I do, I end up scratching my head wondering what movie they saw, honestly.
Yeah.
And most of them, it's because they say that revenge is like a really empty theme that doesn't take you anywhere. And I would agree with that, but I would completely disagree that this film is about that.
You watched the same movie.
Right.
Yeah, so, yeah.
No, well, I have no idea.
Well, then I will kind of hopefully start us down that rabbit trail by asking you this question, Laura. So the movie's called The Revenant. I remember everyone's like scrambling to figure out what the heck does that even mean?
Yeah.
You know, so we all had to go look it up. And for those of you who don't know, and let me go ahead and say this too, we're going to talk about the movie from front to end or from front to back. So if you haven't seen this movie, I would highly recommend you see the movie. But because we're going to talk about everything. So, you know, spoiler alert, what we do kind of for those people who may mm-hmm. be joining us for the first time. But the Revenant defined is a person who has returned, especially supposedly from the dead. Mm-hmm. So, Laura, I ask you, in what ways is this title perfect for this film?
Actually, you know, the obvious thing is that he should be dead, and he's not. He somehow survives.
We're talking about Hugh Glass, the main character.
Yeah, that for all intents and purposes, he should be dead, not just from the first attack, the bear attack, but from anything else that he endures the rest of the film. But it wasn't actually watched this twice, and it wasn't until the second time that I really, the resurrection imagery really mm-hmm. hit me, because I just took it for granted, I guess. I didn't see how many times he literally is emerging from something, like physically emerging from something and has learned something new or has reached a new place or is physically better.
Yeah, because it's not always physical.
Right. It could be spiritual as well. Mm. So, yeah.
Perfect title.
Perfect.
John, you would, I assume you would agree?
I would, yeah, I really would. you know, this is something that's interesting to me, you know, as well about the title, is this idea of coming, you know, from the dead, rising from the dead, this idea of rising out of such a low or desolate place, mm-hmm. Strikes me, because the landscape obviously is stunning in some ways, you know, where the film is shot and where story takes place. But in some ways, that landscape scares me. Mm-hmm. It is desolate in a way that I wouldn't last very long out right. there.
And cruel and impartial, really.
Yes, absolutely. Cruel and impartial. And I often, when I think about desolate landscapes, I'm reminded of the idea of Eden, because we often think of Eden as a paradise, but it's really the garden in Eden that was the paradise. Eden, in, you know, many of the Old Testament mythologies and the Old Testament stories, Eden was actually an area that was a desolate area. It was the fact that the garden, you know, in Eden was so beautiful and prosperous. And in some ways, that speaks to me in this film as well, because in the midst of this desolation, the Eden comes out of Hugh Glass's character from the inside. Mm-hmm. He finds something inside himself that's beautiful and that is lush in the midst of this desolation.
Mm. And if I feel like this could be a bigger topic that, but anyway, I'm just going to go for it.
Just dive in.
I noticed that, to me, there seems to be a huge element in this film of common grace, what I would call mm-hmm. common grace, which is, you know, gifts that are given to you that you don't earn for yourself. They don't come from within. Mm-hmm. And he's constantly, I mean, that's what causes him to survive. You know, I mean, he doesn't put the water there. He doesn't, you know,
he doesn't build his own shelter.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
He is always relying on nature or on other people, mm-hmm. and that, and not only physically, but also spiritually, because he doesn't reach within and say to himself, you can do this, Hugh, you can make it. He's relying on visions of people that love him, that are pulling him mm-hmm. on. So yeah, to me, that's a huge thing that I, that really impressed me, was that I think it would be easy to say, I mean, and the director said that there's a big element of nature being like a healing agent in this mm-hmm. film. And although I think that can be true, like you were saying, John, nature in this film is both good and bad. It's both healing and destructive. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that, you know, nature can't be the thing that is really bringing him healing. It can be an agent of healing, but there's something greater than that. And I feel like that's where a lot of the spiritual imagery comes in. Specifically, he puts a lot of Christian/Catholic imagery in this film.
I was going to say, and I was going to ask you guys about nature, but you've already kind of jumped into it. Both of you kind of talking about how nature plays, like, it's almost a character in this film. Or an agent, if nothing else. And I remember thinking that lots of things didn't hit me until the second time. Mm-hmm. Because, and again, like I said, if you haven't seen the movie, I'm about to spoil the ending. So know that that's going to happen. But it, to me, was a revenge film. It was a revenge film right up until the fact, or up until the time when Hugh Glass basically says, like, you know, like, revenge is in God's hands. Mm-hmm. And when he says that, and he makes the decision not to kill, and we're going to talk about that specifically at some point, but what that did is, in my mind, I went through and replayed the entire film, and everything that happened that I wrote off as just a revenge film, like, every scene changed. Mm-hmm. It rewrote how I saw every scene. And I actually told one friend, I said, even though this film was beautiful, I remember watching it the first time, and up until that last scene, I said, you know, it was beautiful, I was on the edge of my seat, but ultimately it seemed a little too simple, and I probably would have given it like 3, maybe 3.5 stars just for keeping me engaged. But as soon as he drops that line, and I have to rethink the entire film, and especially after seeing it a second time, understanding that Hugh Glass is going through this transformation, mm-hmm. but one common grace miracle, you know, at a time. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, that's what put this, you know, in my top five, mm-hmm. you know, for mm-hmm. the year. Like that changed everything. It gave this movie depth, and nature falls right in line with that. Because like I said, it's a character, and I see its ability not to be good mm-hmm. or bad, really, just be there. But at the same time, it with Glass's wife kind of giving the metaphor for the trees. Mm-hmm. We see nature as a very symbolic idea of what Glass is going through the entire time. Mm-hmm. We, you know, when he is calm, the trees are calm. Mm-hmm. When he is about to die or he's angry, like the trees are rustling and they're about to be blown over. But we, you know, we have this story about how, you know, when you see the wind blowing through the branches, you think the tree will fall over, but you look at the trunk mm. and you realize that it's solid mm. and you realize that it won't be blown over. And
so nature more is a metaphor of a greater truth that yeah. exists.
And so I love the fact that there is that parallel because, you know, one of the best parables that we get in the Bible is about foundation. Mm-hmm. Is we get about, you know, like this guy built his house like this and it went all to crap. This guy did this and it didn't work any better. But
this is the new translation.
This is like yeah, this is the new Fistle translation. You know, so I mean it's working on the similar concept. So, mm-hmm. you know, this whether it's Native American wisdom or Inarutu wisdom, it's still something that we would kind of be able to hang our hat on as Christians as well. Mm-hmm. It's, yeah. you know, if you have a firm enough foundation, or maybe even said even better, it's not necessarily what you are in that moment that mm-hmm. gets you through that moment. It's kind of that foundation.
Mm-hmm. What's underneath yeah,
it's
the
not,
center.
Yeah, it's not the branches of the moment. It's the trunk. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, in our case, it's the foundation. That's what's really getting you through that tough moment. Mm-hmm. That's what's underneath. So I love the fact that you guys went there without even me having to kind of prompt you because, like I said, nature, it just plays such a huge part in this film. It's not, like I said, not just beautiful, but it's deep. Mm-hmm.
And yeah. if I kind of want to return to that, what we were saying before about what is resonating with so many people. And mm-hmm. to me, a word that has continued to come up when I think about this film mm-hmm. is primal. It mm-hmm. feels mm-hmm. primal in so many ways. And in fact, it feels to me almost like Genesis. just not like comparatively, not analogously, mm-hmm. but more because I find in this film just basic truths about what it means to be human and what it means to have a relationship with something greater than you, what it is that we what it is that's in our nature mm-hmm. that we're running from. I mean, there are just so many things that, again, that word primal, that are instinctive to the human soul. And I feel like that's why and I can't wait to talk about Tom Hardy. I love him so much. But that's why it just kind of like I watch this film and I find myself actually just kind of chuckling at it because I feel like there's so many things that are just that people cannot not be resonating with. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that most
Unless
people know what
to.
It is. Yeah. yeah, but most people probably don't know what it is. But it just feels so obvious to me when you see it in light of the gospel and our origin story.
Well, I love that you call it primal because there's a couple interviews that are out there. And there's one specifically that I'll link in the show notes where they're basically talking to Inarutu and they're basically asking him, okay, why did you make the film? What was attractive about the film? Mm-hmm. What are you working out in the film? All the questions you would think someone would want to ask about a film like this. And he talks a lot about revenge and trying to work revenge out. And it comes down, at least to me, to what is primal, which would be like, what do we revert to mm-hmm. As human nature? And even Inarutu talks about how revenge is something that's like constant. Mm-hmm. It's something that you always see through humanity. And then he asked this question. He's like, what, you know, what I wanted to explore in the film was, can revenge really bring back what is lost? Mm-hmm. And I like that there's this rub that's very unprimal. in the film. Because, like I said, when I watched it the first time, it seemed completely primal. Mm-hmm. You have a person who is using revenge as a weapon, or as a tool to survive. But when you bring in some revelation, you start to say, oh, man, there's something else here. There's a different layer. I'm acknowledging a different reality besides mm-hmm. what I can physically see. And it reminded me of the first person I saw who had a review of this film was Elijah Davidson. From Real Spirituality, and I don't think it's actually in his review, but I think when he linked it on social media, he said something to the effect of, "In a world without mercy, every small act of mercy, like doesn't feel small, or something like that, or is huge, or you know something like that." And I remember going into the film seeing this, or with that in the back of my mind, having not read the full review, and I think, is that what you know? Inarritu's like pushing because that's profound. Like, so something that you said at the very beginning, John, was when you look at what, you know, the filmmakers and, you know, the people who are involved in making this film, what they set out to do.
Yeah.
And are they able to accomplish that? Yeah. If one of the things that Inarritu is trying to do is, explore revenge. You think he succeeds?
Yeah.
That's yeah. Like how does he succeed?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that is the question in some ways. You know, with this film is if he had to boil it down, you know, to one thought, to one you know, theme, what is he trying to say? And I think very much the key to what you just said there is the word exploration. I think he does give us an exploration of revenge, and I believe his conclusion is that it's unsustainable. You can't. I wrote a little bit on my blog about this film after it came out that this is a film in some ways that deals with the idea of redemptive violence or the myth of redemptive violence, which is an idea that Walter Wink, who was a great, you know, Christian scholar and writer, put forward. This idea that you hit me, I hit you back twice as hard, you hit me back twice as hard, that the only response to violence is more violence, to hit somebody back, you know, even harder than they hit us. You know, so in the film, Hugh Glass's son is killed, so I'm going to go kill you because you killed my son. And so it's this exploration of, you know, where does it stop? Who is responsible at some point for pulling the plug on redemptive violence? And so I really do believe, you know, that his bottom line theme in the film is that revenge is unsustainable, and that is powerful to me. That resonates with me.
Yeah. So I would agree with you, but I would, and I read your post and I thought it was really great. And I'm basically baiting you to,
it's okay. If you disagree, we can go at it.
No. I feel like I'm asking lots of leading questions because we're all kind of, I feel like we're all on the same page with this film, but, I want to play devil's advocate just so I can give you a chance to further explain, kind of where that is, because you're saying that Inarritu's kind of his conclusion is that revenge is unsustainable. And I think critics or cynics in this case can watch this movie. And in the very last scene, when Hugh Glass has his revelation that revenge isn't going to be enough, you know, because Fitzgerald even says, like, you know, killing me won't bring back your boy, you know, like, or do you think killing me, you know, you come all this way. I've been a student of Tom Hardy.
It's not going to bring your boy back.
So, you know, he even says it. You know, so I think critics and cynics would say that, okay, so your argument is that Glass is ending the cycle of revenge by making this acknowledgement that revenge is in, like, the creator's hands, or, you know, said a different way, like, justice is kind of in the creator's hands. Even though Glass has this revelation, what's the real difference between Glass killing Fitzgerald and letting the Ree do it? I mean, the results are the same. Fitzgerald dies either way. So how is this really being broken?
Yeah. And my argument is that it is broken because of the subtle choice that Hugh Glass makes, that there's no way, you know, that Fitzgerald is going to walk out of that situation alive. Mm-hmm. There's just not.
Mm-hmm.
But Hugh Glass has a choice here. He has a choice of whether or not Fitzgerald will die by his hands or by the hands of another.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is a subtle difference, but it makes all the difference in the world. When we are dealing with a world that is full of evil, when we are dealing with forces in our world that are, purely evil.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy sometimes to say, well, in the battle against things that are evil, I'm willing to bloody my hands,
mm-hmm.
because that's just part of war. And I think we are called to a higher path. I think we're called to a higher road, and we are supposed to be different than those who just respond in violence, even if their end is the same. The difference is, what part will we play in this cosmic drama, if you will? What is our role?
I just feel like that scene is so incredibly done. Mm. And I mean, just brings the film full circle. And I feel like, I don't really know why people don't talk about this as much as that part of the scene,
mm-hmm.
where he lets him go down the river. Because essentially, so if we're talking about revenge as Glass's way of kind of I don't want to say saving himself, but like reaching some kind of closure.
Yeah.
Saving himself, I guess, from grief or whatever. Mm-hmm. In that scene, when he lets Fitzgerald go, he's also surrendering himself to the Ree. They've been hunting him the whole film. So I just feel like it's so significant to mention that he is giving himself up as much as he's giving Fitzgerald up. He doesn't move. He doesn't run away. And the thing that actually saves him in the end is an act of mercy that he did scenes before that he didn't even think about.
It's a great point.
Because The only reason they let him go is because he saved the chief's daughter or whatever.
Yeah. Well, and I think further than that, what people aren't realizing, because there's an assumption, because as viewers, we have inside information that I don't think Glass has in that scene.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Glass knows he's saved someone.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't know that he's saved the someone. You know, he doesn't understand how important that is. He doesn't understand why the Ree are raiding. He just assumes they're raiding because that's what they do.
Right. So he doesn't even do it to save himself. He just does it because he's.
Yeah. So he doesn't think that has any implication on what's going on. And further, I don't think that when he's looking over at the Ree, like, he makes a connection.
Oh, no.
Like, oh, that's her. They're totally going to let me go because I totally did that good thing. I think he just sees, well, these are the people that chased me and made me fall off a cliff and I had to sleep on a horse.
Yeah.
Like, that's what he sees. And he goes, well, here's to both of us. And it just so happens that small acts of mercy in a world without mercy have triggered this kind of snowball.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the justice coming back around.
Or is the physical embodiment of that phrase, revenge is in the hands of the creator, because it shows that evil is going to get its and going to get its comeuppance in the end, and good is going to be rewarded, and that really has nothing to do. We can't manipulate that because Glass doesn't manipulate that purposefully, but just in living his life and being the kind of person he is, being a better man, you know, so there's something inside him that makes him make choices that are more merciful than Fitzgerald, that are more other-centered than Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm. It's gonna happen, but we,
Laura, I think you're onto something there. I think that deserves to be unpacked further, because I think it's worth even looking at this concept of revenge, because I think when we say the word, we have this idea, you know, in our heads of what that means. For some people, and again, I'm not saying these are my thoughts, but for some people, the idea of kind of an eye for an eye is just, mm-hmm. it's justice, you know? Yeah. So in some ways, in the eyes of some viewers in The Revenant, they could look at that film and say, no, it would be justice to punish Fitzgerald for what he did, you know, that's justice. That's not revenge. So what do you guys think? When does something go from being a just, harsh action into the category of revenge? When does it cross that line?
Well, I think outside the context of any specific story, I think that line is so gray that it's hard to define.
And men can't make that choice.
Yeah, and it's really hard to say that any one of us could make that choice. Should we make that choice? I mean, this is the conversation we have every time we have a podcast about a war movie.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you have a not that we've done any podcasts on movies like this, but this is like the Taken franchise. You know, like, isn't it just for a man to do anything to get his family back? Mm-hmm. You know, we're told to defend the defenseless. You know, but I always kind of come back with but what does that mean? Because I think maybe what you're kind of getting at, John, is that lots of people's idea of revenge is often it goes to an extreme. Like, there's not a lot of creative thinking there. You know, it's like terrorists attack us. The only way that we can get terrorists to stop attacking us is to blow them to smithereens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's that myth of redemptive violence.
Yes,
exactly. That idea, and that's exactly what I'm getting at, is I think that is the subtle nuance of this film that a lot of critics missed, and that a lot of viewers, to be quite honest with you, miss as well, is that's the subtlety to me, is that when you're asking where is the line, it's the wrong question. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not even the question, you know, that we should be asking. But I think a lot of people view this film, you know, in particular, and they kind of have their worldview going in to watch the film in a way that, because there's plenty of people of faith out there, you know, who do believe in a justice that would say we punch back when someone punches us.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think that's what is also artistically brilliant about this film, is it forces us into that conversation of, is revenge actually ever an appropriate response? And I think Inarritu is saying no, it's not.
Yeah,
and I love the fact that if I sit and kind of just meditate on what's going through Glass's head there at the end, like, it seems like he's coming to terms with the fact, this thing that I try to argue with people, that it seems almost so high level that most of the time I can't even grasp it. And it's this idea that there's a lot of things that are out of our hands, especially if you believe in a creator. There's a lot of things that we don't have control over. So what do we have control over? And when it comes to how I see, especially in my view of the myth of redemptive violence, that's kind of why I think it's a myth, because I say, okay, well, if, like, what's my part in it? What am I going to do, or what's going to happen? What's the worst that can happen? What's my main mission? Is my main mission to protect my life? Is my main mission to live as long as possible? And like, I start, you know, I have to start asking me these questions as a Christian, like, what is my goal? Why did Christ die? Did Christ die so I could, count up the number of years that I have? you know, like, did he die so I could live in comfort and safety? Like, you know, like, that's how a lot of, you know, I hate to just, you know, give a huge swath of people like this one stereotype, but that's cultural Christianity. You know, Christ came to make us great so we can live comfortable and happy and joyful and
free,
you know, free. What is freedom, liberty, these rights that I have, when, you know, the truth of it is that's not part of the deal at all. The only thing that he was really promising us is that he's going to be there with us, in the midst of that. And so when people were saying, like, aren't you afraid of dying? Aren't you afraid that someone's going to, you know, hurt your family? Aren't you afraid that, you know, if you take this risk, you could be financially ruined? Or, and, you know, there's always a place, and that's why it's such a gray line and so hard to answer. Like, where is the line, John? Because we also are called to be good stewards. We're called to be wise. We're called, you know, called to be smart. We're called to seek counsel. So there's things that maybe we shouldn't do. So it's not a freedom to be irresponsible, but at the same time, I say, well, what's the worst that can happen? I mean, not that I'm eager to die, but if the worst that can happen is that I die, then, I mean, and death is victory for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is why I love Fitzgerald so much.
So, Laura, I think Fitzgerald's pretty great. Is there any reason that you like Fitzgerald?
Oh, man. When I watch him, so the first word that comes to mind when I see his character or watch his character is he's just, like, the most despicable person. He's just, like, slimy and despicable and gross. But if you really think about him, he's almost harmless. I mean, there's just something so creepy and kind of like nebulous about his character. Like, if you listen, he's always talking, so you kind of shut him out a little bit because his mouth is running all the time. But if you really listen to some of the things he's saying, he is definitely racist. He says some awful things to Glass and his son. But for the most part, he's saying things like, "We worked really hard for these pelts. We need this money to survive."
Mm-hmm.
He's saying things like, "This man is mortally injured and we're going to get killed by Indians if we let him slow us down." I mean, these are things that are logical.
They're very practical.
Yeah, they're completely practical. And I just feel like it's hilarious to me for some reason that whoever, what's the writer's name? There was an article you posted with the writer's name.
Mark Smith.
Yeah, they wrote this character that is clearly the villain, but if you really pay attention to him, he's us.
Mm-hmm.
He's the common man without Christ, really, to me, in this situation, because what is at his center is no one else is going to look out for me and mine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in charge of that. And so I'm going to make decisions based on that. And he's just following out his beliefs to their logical conclusion. He's not doing it because he hates other people necessarily. He's doing it because he believes he's the most important. He's the center of the universe and he's the only one who's going to take care of him. And, you know, even think about, so he doesn't try to kill Glass until he actually thinks that Glass is like letting him kill him.
Yeah.
He doesn't even kill, I mean, even though he doesn't like Hawk, he doesn't kill him maliciously necessarily. He does it out of fear. So I just love that that basically the everyday audience that is watching him, I love the thought that they would look at him and say, "What an awful person." But he's us, you know. He's us without Christ. And that's also what I love about his contrast to Glass, because he's actually not that different from Glass in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is that Glass is struggling through his humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something outside of him that is communicating with him, that is trying to teach him something greater, a greater truth about the world or about himself. And he's listening to that. And by proxy, he's doing merciful things. He's respecting the earth. He's, you know, respecting different people. So I just feel like these two guys are just such a, like, again, I return to that idea of Genesis. Like, this is like the first man and it's a picture of them side by side. What would we be like with Christ and what are we like without Christ?
Well, that's why I wrote down as my question, you know, John Fitzgerald, great character, greatest character. because for a lot of the same reasons, I love him too, because I feel like he's one of the most honest characters that we've gotten in a movie in
he's
a long
so
time.
Pure.
He's because, you know, it seems weird that we had heaped praise upon this character, but most people or most characters in movies are intellectually dishonest to their own beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're like, we should just be good to other people, but there's nothing else greater than ourselves. And I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. These are two very, very different things. You know, if like we are all we have and this is the only life we have, what, you know, what onus do I have to do anything for anyone? Mm-hmm. Unless it gains me something. Mm-hmm. And Fitzgerald is the embodiment of his own beliefs.
And what happens to you when that's your end?
And and so he's totally, like I said, I totally love it. And I love the fact, just like you're pointing out, Laura, that much like when we listen to, you know, like, the parable of the prodigal son, like, I love that our reaction to Fitzgerald is usually like most Christians' reaction to the older brother. They're like, well, that doesn't seem very fair, you know, yeah. You know, and they're like, the older brother seems like he's got it together, mm-hmm. You know, when the older brother is us, which is, you know, we don't see that we're either the older brother or we're the younger brother for whatever reason, because we don't see our own shortcomings. Mm-hmm. We don't see. I think I talked about this a couple podcasts ago, where one of the beautiful things about the Old Testament is that the epiphany I had one day, which I should have seen it 100 times, is that like all throughout the Old Testament, like I am Israel. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the nation of Israel is a metaphor for basically every human being on the planet. Mm-hmm. And so like we are all Fitzgerald. And none of us would admit it. We're all like, he's so despicable. Mm-hmm. Why would he do these things?
And yet we live our lives by his code.
Yeah. So if we go back to the things we were talking about earlier about what people value and redemptive violence, you know, like I said, we hear in the news today, oh man, you know, this person committed an atrocity. Well, the only rational thing to do is to go and obliterate them from existence. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the Fitzgerald response. Mm-hmm. That's not the Glass response.
In a well-told story, the antagonist should always have a strong moral argument, mm-hmm. actually, that is different, you know, from the protagonist. And mm-hmm. I think that's what we see here. And Laura was referencing this, that a lot of the things that Fitzgerald says, they're true. Mm-hmm. I always think back, you know, to the Joker in The Dark Knight. If you listen to the Joker's moral argument, most of what he is saying, it's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's how he approaches it. It's how, you know, what he wants to do with that information that's problematic. But what he's saying is true, and it's the same of Fitzgerald. It's really what he wants to do with those truths that's problematic. The second thing, you know, that it makes me think of, especially with this character of Fitzgerald, is in old fables, we like the tortoise and the hare. We hear old fables like that, and we always think that's telling us, oh, so make sure you're the tortoise and not the hare. You know, make sure you're this character and not that. The beauty of old fables were they were never meant to represent two different people. They were always meant to represent two sides of the same person. In other words, inside of all of us is a tortoise and a hare, and we need to listen to that part of us that is the tortoise and not the hare. I would argue that in The Revenant, that really the character of Fitzgerald and the character of Hugh Glass are two sides of the same person. Mm-hmm. I have inside of me a Hugh Glass and I have inside of me a Fitzgerald. Yeah. And those characters are battling with each other constantly. And in some ways, The Revenant is the story of what happens inside of me all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's another reason I resonate, you know, with it.
Hmm. Well, that doesn't seem right because this film's not very deep. It's really just beautiful.
Well, and that is, to return to our idea of justice, that's why it can't be left up to us. That's why it can't be put mm-hmm. in our hands. And that, and also why Glass is actually not really the hero of the story in terms of bringing justice to those who deserve it. Because that part of us that is the same, that has fallen, is going to skew the decisions that we make. Mm-hmm. That has to be made by something greater than us, that has like a higher code or a bigger picture of the world than us.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least.
And that's what that scene feels. Yeah. And that's what that scene feels like to me at the end. Why it was so powerful to me is because it was a big picture. You know, you have these elements that have been happening throughout the whole film and suddenly they're all together in one scene and you realize this is what's been going on the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's interesting. I like what you say there, Laura, about you know, the idea of a big picture and kind of small perspectives of these characters, because really every character in this film is only getting a small little piece of the story, just a small little perspective, you know, whether it's Glass or whether it's Fitzgerald or whether it's Gleason's character, you know, back at the fort. Every person in this film only sees a small little bit. Maybe in some ways the nature and the mountains in this film are representative of God in some ways, in that in the midst of these grand landscapes that are immovable, every little person is just wandering around kind of on their own mission, seeing their own little little piece of the story. But these mountains in some ways see the whole story. They see every person in the wilderness. They see every person's story. And in some ways, they embody the truth of the whole situation that no one of these characters could embody by themselves.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna say we're getting close to time, and we hit like a lull. But I want to give you.
It's not a lull. It's just we reached the end of that.
That thought, yeah. and so I want to give you guys a chance to mention anything else that you want to talk about, and we'll do that in final thoughts. But I want to make sure we're at least heading towards the exit door, because I think this movie gives us, it has so much depth, to the contrary of many detractors, that we could talk about this for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And so we do that by looking at the things that we liked and disliked about the film specifically. So, John, at the beginning of the podcast, you talked about how, you know, this isn't a perfect film.
Yeah.
Like, there are things that can be criticized about this film.
Yeah.
So what would you say were one or two of those things for you? And typically, you know, we refer to this as our come on moments, like things that could have been done better, like maybe a character, a shot, an arc, a theme, anything like that is really up for game or up for grabs.
Well, I am embarrassed to say I'm going to go for some low-hanging fruit here. there's been a lot of discussion of the bear/rape scene where Hugh Glass is brutally, brutally ravaged by this bear. And while it's a powerful scene, while it's a powerful moment, I did feel like after a while, okay, we've got this amazing CGI bear. We have this brutal attack. After a while, I felt like we were dwelling on this just because we could. For me, that was kind of a come on moment. It was like, okay, I get it. He is is torn to pieces by this bear. Can we please move on? So that was just a moment, you know, that I somewhat struggled with. The other piece, and this is a bit more practical, is I don't know. I've seen the movie more than once. Every time I struggled with understanding some of the characters' words, their dialogue in key scenes. I felt like what they were saying I was supposed to get and was important. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if, you know, they just had trouble going back and re-recording those lines, or I don't know what happened there, but I do feel like, you know, just from a critical film perspective, I shouldn't have to fight to hear what key moments are in the film from characters. And I felt like I had to do that. So those are two thoughts, you know, things that, that I wish had been different about the film.
Mm-hmm. I think those are fair.
Mm-hmm.
Laura.
So I completely, okay, maybe I shouldn't qualify what I'm about to say. At some point, well, I say at some point, I know at what point, when the horse goes over the cliff and he survives that, he survives that only to have to, like, cut the horse open and crawl inside it.
After he took all his guts out,
I just was pretty much laughing because I have this image in my brain of people sitting around a writer's table and the, like, you know, the lead writer or whatever being like, okay, what is the worst thing you can imagine happening to yourself in the wilderness? And he just like went around and took everyone's idea and put it all in the film.
So Laura, I made a list. See that as an homage to the Empire Strikes Back, the Tauntaun Empire Strikes Back. It was an homage. Surely.
Oh, well, that makes it okay. Mm. But yeah, so I made a list of all the things that he survives.
Yeah.
He's mauled by a bear. He's crushed underneath the bear. Yeah. It doesn't even end there. He survives freezing temperatures, near starvation. He floats down a frozen river for a while. He sets off gunpowder on his own neck. He escapes the Ree Indians and then escapes an entire camp of French trappers. Then he falls off a cliff and he survives a blizzard inside a horse. And then he ends up having a knife fight that he also survives. So anyway, part of the remarkable thing about this film is watching this person survive mm-hmm. despite all odds.
Yeah.
But I think when that horse went over the cliff, I was like, come on, how much more what else is going to happen to this dude?
Yeah. Yeah. So I would say mine's pretty similar. There's like my whole beef was having to suspend disbelief at some point. Mm-hmm. I can imagine that revenge and adrenaline can power a human being through a lot of things. Mm-hmm. But in freezing temperatures, like being exposed for that long, I feel like Glass should have like lost some fingers or some toes from frostbite, especially having gone down the river.
Yeah.
But
how do you get dry from that when you're in snow?
Yeah. It's like, no, don't worry, I'm not in the river anymore. I'm sitting in the snow.
Yeah.
So now I'm drying off. You know, I mean, bear skin, big, heavy bear skin. Hey, sure, that helps. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he always seemed to have just the tiniest of fires. And I feel like anyone who's ever been outside when it's cold and built a fire realize how big that fire has to be before it really puts off any heat.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You know, it adds to the mythos of the film. It adds to the grandeur, to the spectacle. And for the most part, it didn't detract so much that it was, I would consider it bad. But at some point, like, you know, especially when he goes off the cliff, mm-hmm. You know, and it's not that there is a random series of fortunate events that could have him have a lot of branches break his fall on the way down. Mm-hmm. But, That's a lot of broken bones.
It's a lot of common grace.
Yeah. So, the suspension of disbelief was hard. But you know, like I said, at
but
the same
somehow
time,
still didn't make me.
Yeah, didn't turn me off.
It really didn't turn me off from the film. I don't know. I guess I just noticed it. But. Mm.
So let's switch gears. And John, I'll ask you now: what was your favorite parts about this movie?
Yeah. I, besides, you know, we've talked about that end scene quite a bit. Mm-hmm. That's definitely one of my favorite parts of the film. But the scene that scene actually references may be my favorite part of the film. This is when Hugh Glass comes upon another man. And there's this other man who has been, his people, his tribe was wiped out. Mm-hmm. And he's going on trying to find this, you know, more of his people. And so this is really what baffles Hugh Glass is, why aren't you going for revenge? Mm-hmm. You know, if these people wiped out your people, why aren't you going for revenge? And it's at this moment that this man, who I think is kind of the unsung hero of the film, because he's the one who really puts this thought in Hugh Glass's head that revenge is in the hands of the creator. This man is living out this truth in front of Hugh Glass. He doesn't just say it. He's living it out in front of him. And to me, that is kind of the easily forgotten moment of the film, that Hugh Glass was not just impacted by a man's words. He was impacted because he saw this man living out those words. Mm-hmm. And what a powerful moment in this film. So I think that's probably my favorite moment in the film.
Yeah. And I, like to expand upon that, I just want to say that I think that concept in and of itself is what is so incredibly hard to convey to people. Because, like I said, I keep going back to this well of, like, you know, someone does harm to you. You feel like the only way to get justice is to, you know, eradicate them from the face of the earth, or, you know, hit them back harder. And I've had this conversation, I know, with Laura tons of times about, like, what is your end goal? Is your end goal to change someone's behavior or to change someone's heart? And I feel like one of the things that allows Christianity to spread in some of the lesser developed places in the world is because people are doing exactly what you're talking about, John. They're living it. Like in, you know, in early Christianity, when people are praying while being fed to lions because of their belief, instead of gathering swords and fighting back, like, there's something about that that's compelling. I think it's one of the reasons, and we talked about this on Selma with you, John, last year. You know, one of the things, one of the reasons that Martin Luther King Jr. is held up so high as an example is because ultimately violence isn't going to change someone's someone's heart. I mean, it might deepen the wound that's in the heart, but it won't change their heart. It's only that forgiveness, that grace, that mercy. And I do. I also love that character. And I feel like after Glass has to be saved by this guy who has foregone revenge, and then still sees that even after foregoing revenge, he is killed. I think that, you know, he can also choose to revenge that guy, you know? But ultimately he takes, you know, he's like, if this guy's willing, you know, he's an Indian in a world where it's not safe to be an Indian. And he still chooses to live this way. Maybe I should think about my own beliefs. And I think if more, more people of faith live that way, then I think faith would be more appealing to people who didn't have it.
Good word.
Man, there's such great examples too in our world and in history of how effective that is. I mean, if you think about Rwanda after the genocide or Nelson Mandela, you know, I feel like there's evidence that shows that that taking a different path can actually.
Yeah, but it's harder.
Oh yeah.
Not only is it harder, but you risk death.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. Because like his honey friend ended up hanging from a tree.
Yeah. And the Fitzgerald inside us says no.
Yeah, that's right.
But that's where it comes, like, whatever our core belief about the purpose of life, that's where that comes in. You know, is my safety the highest goal? You know, I guess we could talk about it ad nauseum, but I mean, his friend is hanging, but somehow Glass is not found in the, you know, the thing that he made him, the sweat lodge he made him.
Yeah.
I mean, my only conclusion for that is that his friend didn't give him up.
Yeah.
And they weren't friends that long, you know? So he really followed that belief out to its end.
So, now that we've all again agreed on that, Laura, what is your favorite part?
I feel like this is going to be super shallow now, but
well, I like the bear scene.
I feel like this is shallow because I'm not 100% sure. I guess I haven't worked out why, but I just love the scene when Glass is sitting across from the captain or whatever. And he says, he knows how far I came to find him. He's scared, you know?
I ain't gotta die.
Yeah.
I ain't afraid to die.
And I've done that already.
I
mean, just kind of like the hardened, you know, and even like watching him walking around in this bear, I'm assuming, well, if it's not the skin of the bear that he killed, you know, it's representative of the fact that he killed the bear and he's walking around with the claw of the bear he killed. Just kind of, there's just something so compelling to me. Yes, even as a woman, about seeing the strength of the human spirit, you know, just seeing what we're capable of doing. And there's something in there too about the reoccurring theme, as long as you have breath, You know, that's basically, mm-hmm. that's your responsibility. As long as God has given you breath in your lungs, your responsibility is to draw that breath and until it's no longer there. Mm-hmm. And so just to watch him, you know, just to watch how, like, just how awesome he is and all the stuff that he endures and just, I don't know, there's just something super powerful to me about that. And I just love the way that DiCaprio delivers those lines because they're so powerful, but he's basically whispering them. Mm-hmm. So anyway,
oh, I gotta make some notes real quick. Impress why
kill a bear and wear its skin.
Wrestle bear with bare hands. Wear bear skin. Wear claws on neck.
Well, because you know, I mean, the idea of justice is, I mean, I want somebody, I want a hero like that in my life. Mm-hmm. You know, because
Laura needs hero.
You know, I think also I have trouble with this too, because I don't think Glass is a Jesus figure really. Mm-hmm. But when I think about, I mean, when I think about the hardships that have come to me in my life that I have not been able to endure on my own, mm-hmm. I needed something greater than myself. I mean, it's kind of like the same appeal of fairy tales where you have the prince, the, you know, the knight that's like running after the damsel in distress. I mm-hmm. want somebody who is strong, who can stand up against the worst things that the world can throw at them, mm-hmm. And bring about justice. You know, it can, I don't know.
Well, and the trick is that that's not actually a person that exists.
Right. Yeah.
Good. Cause that kind of lets me off the hook.
No, I don't believe that person exists. That's why I'm saying he's not really a Jesus figure. But what I'm really saying is that, like I need Jesus. I need like a Hugh Glass kind of Jesus. Mm-hmm. Who's like, you know, who was not overcome by anything.
Yeah.
But overcomes everything.
Can we say that the closest person to being that prince is probably Tom Hardy in real life?
Yeah.
I feel like it's worth saying. Yes. I mean, guys, here's the thing. I'm a straight man, but that is a good-looking dude right there. I'll be real honest.
Mm-hmm. Even with his scalp half gone?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Could I be Tom Hardy? Yeah. That is, wow.
He's the... women want to be with him and men want to be him, mm-hmm. or whatever, how that old adage goes. You know? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, God, he was Max and he was Fitzgerald and he was that dude where he was playing himself twice.
And he was Bane.
He was Bane.
Yeah.
And he was clone Patrick Stewart in the Star Trek
movie.
I love
that he really is like a pretty boy. But he plays like such a variety of characters. Mm-hmm. He plays some of the like most roughed up, ugly, wild, crazy people.
Note: P.S. Also be beautiful like Tom Hardy. Oh gosh, this is also good. So I'm going to mention two things as my favorite parts of this movie. One is simply a scene, not because of its thematic depth, just because of its cinematic amazingness. And that is the opening scene. Mm-hmm. I feel like I haven't seen an opening scene that left me on the edge of my seat in a theater that much since maybe Gladiator.
Yeah.
When I'm watching that, you know, I'm watching Ridley Scott like pan across like the fiery arrows, like in the battle against the Gauls or whatever, mm-hmm. And or like even going back further and like the D-Day invasion, and Saving Private Ryan. Given the Private Ryan doesn't, it kind of is another category because it's much much longer than this opening scene, and you know the fact that it's a you know like kind of one long shot opening scene. So many
I'll
things.
I'll never
are
look at bow and arrows the same way
exactly
again after that scene.
They became instantly deadly, not just like the thing that misses all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that scene, I just thought for various reasons was incredibly done technically, cinematically, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The other thing that really struck me. Was the fact that, I want to say it was Iñárritu that mentioned this in an interview, but he kept talking about like the cycles of how death keeps leading to life. Mm. And I love the fact that there's a conversation to be had that I think we could have if we had more time about death and resurrection, mm-hmm. and how death and resurrection is a cycle of the world. It's a cycle of life because mm-hmm. it's a cycle of the Christian life, because it's one of those truths that is there, whether you believe it or not. So whether you're a Christian or a non-Christian, you know, whatever you believe, like there is either your belief system has some kind of myth or view on things that kind of have to die to come back alive, mm-hmm. to bring new life, or you recognize the fact that sometimes there needs to be like a fall that has to happen for something to get back up.
Or just watching the metaphor of nature.
Yeah, or just watching nature. Yeah. You know, right. And I think that's one of the beautiful things, you know, going back to nature as well. I think if we watch nature and watch the things that happen in nature, we can find a lot of God's truth, because mm-hmm. it's, you know, something that he breathes into creation is going to pattern itself on the creator. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. There's a lot of... very interesting and deep stuff there, I think, with death and resurrection, and very powerful stuff. Like I said, I think if you have time to have that conversation, mm-hmm. which, like I said, I think we might not have time to do. But like I said, I love the fact, you know, it's that birth imagery over and over, mm-hmm. You know, spiritual rebirth, physical rebirth. We get to see that over and over, and the power of it. Mm-hmm. So that made, like I said, that was one of those things I picked up from the very last scene, kind of made me realize that I'd been watching that the whole time mm-hmm. and somehow had missed it. And watching it a second time, it was so obvious that I almost felt dumb for missing it the first time.
Yeah.
So, but again, the film's so beautiful, I can understand why I did. well, our kind of final piece is what I like, you know, I like to give everyone a chance to kind of throw out some final thoughts. This can be really anything that you want it to be. This is kind of like the catch-all. So, John, I wanted to give you a chance. If there's anything that we missed, if there's any kind of recommendation, or just anything that you wanted to say about this film, now is the time to say it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Well, first let me say thanks again for having me on to mm-hmm. talk about this film, because, you know, sometimes I'm asked to come on a podcast and I get to talk about Daddy's Home. So it's so nice to talk about, you know, a film of substance.
With death and resurrection.
Yes, exactly. I just want to really kind of pick up on what you were talking about there, that that theme of death and resurrection, I feel like, is so key, you know, to getting this film. And I would highly recommend, you know, that people, this is one of those films that, to me, you can go and watch more than once and mm-hmm. get more out of it, probably after a second or third viewing. So that's probably what I would like to, encourage people to do, or encourage people to look at, is a lot of what we've talked about, you know, on this podcast comes out of the fact that we have seen the film more than once, mm-hmm. and certain films, certain stories are worth engaging on a deeper level. They're worth seeing more than once. And I feel like this is one of those stories. So, see this film more than once, because I think it'll speak to you differently, on a second viewing.
Mm. I think that's great advice, as experienced personally. Laura, same thing. Is there anything that we didn't get a chance to hit, or you wanted to kind of leave a thought that you wanted to leave everyone with?
I think after reading the some of the reviews or interviews, really, that you sent out between or of Inuratu, speaking of creating this film, it was so endearing to me, maybe, to know that what I saw in the film was, it felt like a direct connection to what he was trying to give to me as a viewer.
Mm-hmm.
Like I didn't feel at all like he was pandering to the audience to give, you know, to purely give them something that he knew they would enjoy.
Yeah.
He was making this film because there was a story that was really compelling to him, that had questions that were really compelling to him. And some of those, I loved reading those interviews, because I loved to hear his process about trying to figure out where the story was going and what he wanted to tell. And some of those things were, you know, what we said about revenge not being, never really having a satisfying end. He also mentioned that when he read Hugh Glass's story, he wondered, what would it take, you know, what would it take to get you to survive this kind of element,
mm-hmm.
or these kinds mm-hmm. of elements,
because it's loosely based on a true
right.
story.
Yeah. A very mm-hmm. loose story.
an impressive story in and of itself.
Yeah. And just hearing about his process too, it was cool to know that he shot it chronologically because he felt like because he wanted the characters to evolve as the film was evolving. He wanted them to discover things about themselves as the story was told and to portray that through their performances. And just the commitment to letting the natural landscape be natural, even when it was detrimental to their shooting schedule, and committing to using natural light. All of those things were really important into making this film what it, how powerful it is. And I just love that, I don't know, it felt like I've collaborated with artists before, and I love that feeling that we're all in this together, kind of exploring these big questions together and enjoying beauty together. And I felt like I was able to do that with a stranger.
I was going to say, I'm glad you brought up the whole like natural light and chronological thing. There's a lot of technical things we didn't talk about in this film that I think deserve a lot of praise. It's why I would not be surprised, you know, if he's up there, you know, gathering another trophy for best director, either him or George Miller, for their incredible work, basically doing very similarly fantastic and mind-blowing things in their films these years, this year. So if you haven't read anything about some of the things that they've done to make this film, I encourage you to seek out and read these things. If you are impressed by filmmaking at all, or if filmmaking is a hobby of yours or interesting to you, you should really read what like people like Inarritu are doing when making films, or George Miller, like I said, again, George Miller, just these people who have a vision and they're able to tell a story in a way that few have done, if anyone. So, the only other thing that I'd say is, like many things, I want to make sure that people know, especially when we love a film so much, that we, you know, we kind of point out, like, there's some hard stuff in this film, and not everyone's going to like it. I mean, you know, I know people who have seen this movie and it was just too, like, it was too visually tough because it doesn't,
it's violent.
It's unrelenting. Yep. Yeah. It's unrelenting, in, the hardships that Hugh Glass goes through. So, you know, kind of keep that in mind. Because it is awesome doesn't mean that you should take everyone of your friends, you know, be mindful of them. So, outside of that, I do echo what John's saying. If you do resonate with it all, I would recommend seeing it again. Because I think you'll get something out of it different the second time, and maybe even a third time. I think it's well worth your time. If you can see this in the theater, it'd probably be even better. It's meant to be viewed on a biggest screen as possible. So with that said, I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. And as I have been in the habit of saying recently, you can't have a great conversation without great conversatees. So I wanted to give us a chance to, I want to give you the listener the chance to kind of continue these conversations, if you so choose, with our guests by following their work or following them on social media. So John, where can people find, I guess, one of the many places that you do anything and or follow you on social media or anything like that?
Yeah. Well, I would love to engage and talk to people about their thoughts about this film or any others. I'm on Twitter at John K B U C H E R, and come check out my blog at welcometothesideshow.org.
Excellent. And I'll make sure we have all that in the show notes, along with whatever Laura's getting ready to tell us.
Well, I'm on Twitter at Laura_Fizzle, and then. Mostly right now I've been focusing on writing, Doctor Who reviews for Real World Theology.
A worthy use of anyone's time.
And I would love to have conversations about Doctor Who. So please comment if you read.
Well, and like I said, I will make sure that all that stuff is on realworldtheology.com. Under this episode, we'll have show notes and links to all those places. You'll also be able to comment or join the Real World Theology discussion group on Facebook. You can get, you know, if you like this episode, you can, like I said, keep it going. I'll make sure that John and Laura get in there and respond to any comments that you have, any questions, anything we didn't cover, anywhere you think we're wrong. If you think redemptive violence is the best thing in the entire world, come and tell us, and we will have that discussion, because that's the beauty of discussion. Meanwhile, if you want to get in contact with me, you can follow me on Twitter. It's probably the easiest thing, @Fizzification. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast, however you subscribe to podcast. And again, like I said, make sure you're following our excellent guest. Please follow them on social media. Follow the show on social media. I want to give a special thanks to you, the listeners, for taking time. There are so many podcasts out there. There are so many good podcasts. And you take time to listen to this one. I am super grateful. Thank you for making this a part of your week. So until next episode, please remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless.
And revenge is in the hands of the creator.
I hear her. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
So I just see how many podcasts you're on. I'm like, man, think about how much money, you know, John's raking in being a guest on all these podcasts.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah. I tell you what, the first dollar I make on from being on a podcast, I will put on the wall, but the wall is empty, my friends.
So much space. So much space.